pathology evidence and evidence of post-mortems are distressing by nature, very graphic by nature. Obviously, a lot of medical evidence put to the jurors yesterday. I'll tread as carefully as I can, but it is very important, I suppose, for the jury and also from a reportage point of view, to share Dr. Sally Ann Collis's conclusions. Mm-hmm. She spent the guts of 2 hours in the witness box yesterday. This is the pathologist who carried out the post-mortem a day after Aisling Murphy's body was found in that ditch along the Grand Canal in Tullamore. And she described what Aisling was wearing when she received her body. She said that she had a grey scarf, heavily blood-stained scarf, a green and blue blood-stained tracksuit top, blue leggings, a white T-shirt, which was also heavily blood-stained over the neck, back and sides. She had a yellow metal necklace on with a pendant which read Aisling. She said that she also had a smartwatch on her, which appeared to have run out of battery, and she had a clatter ring on her middle finger, on her right hand. She then gave details of 12 sharp force injuries, 11 of which were stab wounds. She said all of them were inflicted to the right side of Aisling's neck, and she described how some vital veins and an artery were damaged. She said that would have caused huge blood loss. And when asked what would have caused those wounds, she said they were most likely caused by a knife or knives or a similar implement, most likely with a single-edged blade. She labelled all of those 12 wounds, and she went through them in great detail with the jury yesterday. There's no need to, I suppose, share all of the graphic detail about those injuries with your listeners today. Safe to say that she couldn't tell the sequence of those injuries. So while each one was labelled in sequence, she couldn't tell the order that they were actually inflicted in. So in the end, as I say, she concluded that Aisling died from multiple sharp wounds to the neck with no contributory factors.
Could Aisling Murphy have called for help?
Well, again, and I suppose without going into too much detail, we did hear about one particular injury to her voice box, as you say, or an injury to her neck which caused damage to her voice box. And in relation to that, Dr. Collis said that she didn't think Aisling would have been able to speak or make an intelligible sound. She said that due to the injuries, she had lost a lot of blood, so much so that her body couldn't properly function. And she said that she went into cardio respiratory arrest. She was cross-examined by Mr. Pushka's barrister, and during that cross-examination, she again said, this was something that she touched on in her direct evidence, that she couldn't completely exclude the possibility of strangulation, that there may have been pressure or compression to Aisling's neck. She couldn't definitively say whether or not there was, but she concluded that Aisling had died from those stab wounds to her neck. And given the fact that all of those stab wounds were to the right side of Aisling's neck, as I say, it was put to her, again under cross-examination, that a right-handed person would naturally strike to the opposite side of the neck, the left-hand side. And Dr. Collis agreed, but she said that was provided they were both facing each other. She then said later on that an attack such as that would be quite dynamic, and she outlined how Aisling's head may have been to one side, or that the blade may have moved, or that the side of Aisling's neck may have been exposed. And I suppose just to touch on something you said a little bit earlier, you know, just in relation to the distressing details, you know, and the evidence of the first responders, which we may touch on in a moment or two. Obviously very difficult evidence to hear, but the jury was already told, and indeed juries in any criminal trial are always told, you know, leave emotion to one side, to leave sympathy to one side, and to just look at the evidence, you know, in a cold, clinical and dispassionate way. So they were given that warning at the beginning of this trial, and obviously very difficult evidence to hear yesterday morning, and indeed in the afternoon when Dr. Collis stepped into the witness box. But the jury have been warned on a number of occasions that they need to just focus on the evidence and not any emotion or sympathy in the case, because that has no place in the work of the jury.
The first responders who arrived on the scene give evidence of how they attempted to help Aisling. Take us through what they said in court yesterday.
Well, we heard there was a 3-car convoy that was sent to the scene after the call came in that afternoon, sent to the scene from Tullamore Garda Station. A Garda, Tom Dunn, was in the public office that afternoon. He took a panicked call from a member of the public. He said the caller wasn't making an awful lot of sense. He was talking about an assault along the canal there in Tullamore, but he did just try and establish as best he could where exactly this person was calling from. And after putting the phone down, he said he went straight upstairs to the detective office in Tullamore Garda Station. He was seeking assistance. Three cars, as they say, were sent straight down. Garda Dunn jumped in a patrol car himself with a colleague of his. They met some people at Digby Bridge along the canal, which I'm sure would be very familiar to your listeners. The jury throughout this trial have been shown maps and photographs of the various locations, and Aisling's body was found a little bit down from Digby Bridge. They were pointed in the direction of the ditch where her body was, and once there they met the man who had made the call, a man called Enda Malloy, who the jury has heard from earlier this week. There was also another man there. That person has also given evidence to the jury, and he said he went down to the ditch, and at that point he wasn't sure if Aisling was still alive, so he started to perform CPR with his colleagues. They were taking turns doing chest compressions until the paramedics arrived. We heard from all of the Gardaí who attended in that three-car convoy. Detective Sergeant David Scahill was also there. You know, he was Garda Dunn, and his colleague were first on the scene, and they were followed closely behind by Detective Sergeant Scahill. He said that when he arrived, he could see Garda Dunn kneeling down in the hedge. He could see that he was doing CPR on a woman. He asked him if there was a pulse. He said that Garda Dunn wasn't sure, but he thought there might be a faint pulse. So he kept doing those chest compressions with his colleague, Garda Hunter. And he said that he knew it was a woman because of her leggings. He could also see her blonde hair. He rang 999 shortly after getting out of his own car at the scene. This was at 3:46 p.m. He wanted to see if there was an ambulance on the way. There was. He gave them some further directions as to exactly where they had to go. And as this was going on, he said the two lads just continued to do those chest compressions. He said they were doing the best they could. The paramedics arrived shortly afterwards, and they took control of the situation. Aisling was in a ditch in some heavy undergrowth, as we've heard earlier this week. The canal is elevated, so it was quite difficult for the paramedics to get down and do any work on the body. So a decision was made to bring it up out of the ditch onto the towpath, and the Gardaí assisted the paramedics in bringing her up. And again, just for some of your listeners who may be joining the show at this moment and mightn't have heard those previous warnings, it might be helpful to just reiterate that warning, that, you know, some of the details that were heard yesterday.
There was a description of a man seen on the canal before the attack discussed yesterday as well.
That's right. A civilian witness called Emma Malloy gave evidence yesterday. She described this man as having striking and unusual eyes. She said they were real light, pale eyes. According to her, he had a tight, crew-cut haircut, slight stubble, and sallow skin. And she said that when she saw him, he was wearing a black tracksuit top with what appeared to be a red logo on the chest area and dark tracksuit bottoms. Now, this witness, Emma Malloy, said she saw this man cycling along the Grand Canal while she was out for a walk with her dog that afternoon. This would have been, before the alleged murder of Aisling Murphy. And she said that as she was walking along, she saw a woman coming around the corner. She noticed this man on his bike behind the woman. She said they were close to one another. She wasn't sure if they were together, but that this man then cycled past the woman, passed her out too on his bike, and she said that he said hello to her as he passed. She said that she didn't think he was Irish, and when asked about the bike, she said it was neon green on the front, and she said its handlebars were straight. And she told the jury that not long after she returned to her parents' house after her walk along the canal, she described how Aoife Maran and Jenna Stack called over looking shocked and upset about something. The jury has already heard from Aoife Maran and Jenna Stack. They raised the alarm that day. Jenna gave evidence of stumbling upon a man leaning over a woman in a hedge along the canal. And Emma Malloy, in her evidence yesterday, said that she was told by the women that a girl had been attacked down the canal.
Frank, today the court case continues. What do we expect that jurors will hear?
We don't know for sure, but the prosecuting barrister, Ms. Anne-Marie Lawler, did mention in front of the jury at some point yesterday that they may see some CCTV footage today. We were told in her opening speech that 25,000 hours of CCTV were harvested as part of the Garda investigation. They obviously won't be shown all 25,000 hours. We were told that a compilation was was made of all of that footage, and they will be shown that in due course. Again, she mentioned that yesterday, but we won't know for sure until the court reconvenes in a little over half an hour.
Frank, very quickly, I think it's worth reminding people listening to this that in this era of social media, the temptation is to always comment, to always share our opinions online. But in cases in when something is before the courts, it's incredibly important not to say anything on social media that might interfere with the ongoing proceedings, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I'm really glad you've brought that up, because this case is now sub judice, which is Latin and essentially means under a judge. It's under judicial review. The case is now in the hands of the jurors, and it is up to them, the 9 men and the 3 women of this jury, to decide on the evidence. It's not for anybody else. And I suppose people like myself, all we can do day to day is report on what the jury hears and sees in an impartial and fair and balanced way. There is no room for opinion, there is no room for anything like that. And you know, that applies to not just journalists like myself, but also members of the public who are sitting and watching the trial day to day, and people who may be following it from afar. They shouldn't publish, broadcast, post anything online that might affect or prejudice the jury's work in any way. And there are very serious consequences if somebody doesn't abide by that sub judice rule. We have seen in cases in the past, people being prosecuted for going online and breaking that very, very important rule. So I'm glad you've brought that up.